Turn to Proverbs 7:14. So we're still talking about strange woman. And in verse 13, if you'll remember from last time, it says, "So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him." And now we are going to get to the first thing that she says. These are the first words that she utters to this young man. And she says, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." So we saw last time that she catches him and aggressively kisses him like a slut, as we saw from the definition of the word. And now she tries to shamelessly feign religion to deceive the young man to think that she's actually a good woman. Now, this shouldn't have worked just based on her previous action and attire, which we'll look at here in a second. But, you know, people do this, and you want to beware of people that try to hide their sin under a cloak of religion. And there's plenty of people that do it. There's most of these guys on television, the televangelists, they figured out a good way to make a lot of money under the cloak of religion. And there's a lot of people, a lot of evil people that go to church at least every once in a while, and they claim to be a part of a religion. Most of the presidents have claimed to be Christian. I think probably all of them have, right? And a lot of the people that do really terrible things in this world do so under the cloak of religion. Think about all the things the Catholic Church has done, all the persecution and then all the abuse, all the things they've done under all these priests under the name of religion. And so this is nothing new, and this is exactly what this woman is trying to do. And that's why it's so important that we know people by their fruits, not just by what they say. So let's just look at a couple of verses here that tell us that we should examine what people do, not so much what they say. Matthew 7 and verse 20 is the first one. But what people say is important too, but as the old saying goes, talk is cheap. People can talk a good talk. Probably just about anybody can figure out how to say, "I love God. I trust God, right? God is so good to me," right? Things like that. I mean, anybody, nobody, you don't need grace. You don't need anything. You just need to be around Christianity for about 10 seconds and you can figure out how to say that. So just things like that aren't quite enough. Matthew 7 and verse 20, Jesus is talking about false prophets. And he says, "Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them." If you walk up to a tree and you see certain fruit on it, and if it's red and has kind of a hard, edible outside exterior to it, you can probably figure that, oh, that's an apple tree, right? You know the tree by its fruit. Or if you see oranges on it, it's an orange tree, right? You wouldn't expect to see almonds on a grapefruit tree, right? So you'll know the tree by its fruit. So as Christians, we should be fruit inspectors. We should, you know, take a look at how somebody lives and then by that determine whether we trust that they are a genuine believer or not. Now look at Matthew 12 and verses 33 through 35. Jesus said, "Either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt, for a tree is known by his fruit. O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh." See, these people, they don't even have good words or good fruits, because what's in their heart is coming out. And if you listen to somebody long enough, even if they do sound godly, you keep listening, and you listen whenever they don't think another believer's listening, or when they're not in front of other people, they don't realize that other people are hearing what they're saying, then hear what they say, and that might tip you off as well. "A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things." So that's how we identify people by their fruits, not just by their words, because words are deceptive. Look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. But really, it's the same thing with fruits and words. Both of those things can be feigned. Remember Judas Iscariot. He was a philanthropist. He was indignant about the fact that this woman took this ointment and anointed Jesus' feet with it, and it could have been sold for 300 pence and given to the poor, right? He was using this cloak of piety to hide his covetousness, because they said later in another place that he said this, or maybe in the same place, he said this because he was a thief and he had the bag. So he wanted that 300 pence because he could take care of himself, not the poor with it. And a lot of that goes on as well. So you got to examine what people say and do, and then keep examining, because sometimes they can trick you for a while. 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words are fake words, right? Paul said that Timothy had an unfeigned faith, an unpretended faith, not a fake faith, but a real, genuine, true faith. But these people with feigned words, with pretended words, make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. And that's a really good description of these televangelists. Feigned words make merchandise of you. They make a lot of money off of unsuspecting people. A lot of old ladies, as a matter of fact. Probably old ladies get swindled more by these televangelists than anybody else. And it's just terrible. And that's what they do, though, with the feigned words. And then down in verse 18, it says, "For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error." Now, this really matches up with what the strange woman is doing here. She, through great swelling words of vanity, as we'll see, she allures through much wantonness, which is like lust, you know, sexual lust kind of thing. So that's how she allures the young man with these good words and fair speeches and her attractive appeal. So he should have been paying attention to not just what she said, but how she dressed, what she did. And he didn't. He was deceived by her, as we will see as we go through this. So she says there, "I have peace offerings with me." Now, peace offerings were a part of the religious service of the Jews. And we can see that back in Leviticus 7 and verse 11. This probably wouldn't mean a whole lot to people today. If you're very familiar with the Old Testament law, then peace offering might bring you something to mind. But today, if somebody came up to you and said, "I have peace offerings with me," you'd be like, "What's that mean?" Right? And you know, it's really not kind of a strange pickup line, right? I've never had a woman come up to me and say, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." I never used that one either. Probably wouldn't have got you too far. But a Jew in the Old Testament would have known exactly what this was referring to. Because remember, they are right outside Solomon's castle. They're right in Jerusalem, which is the heart and soul of Israel and its religion, right where the temple was. Leviticus 7 and verse 11, it says, "And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he shall offer unto the Lord." Now, I'll get into the peace offering itself here in a little bit, but I just wanted to show you that this is part of the law of Moses, the law of the peace offering. Now, this was said, as far as I can tell, to convey two things, at least. These two things would have been conveyed by that statement, "I have peace offerings with me." First of all, it implied that she was religious. She's a keeper of the law of Moses, because that's what the peace offering was all about. It was made in the temple, right? So clearly she's religious. Secondly, it would have indicated that she was well off because she had the means to offer a beast as a peace offering, and we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But part of the peace offering was a beast, an ox or a sheep, a large beast, which were not exactly cheap. You remember Jesus' mother, when she gave birth to him, and then she went in and made the offering in the temple, and she offered a pigeon or a turtle dove, and that was the offering of the poor. So poor people offered those little birds. People with wealth would offer the larger animal. And the peace offering, unless I missed something, and maybe there was other animals for the peace offering, but the ones that I was reading about here were the larger animals. So it would indicate that she was a little better off. And we'll talk about that here in a second. So these two things would make the young man think that she was a decent woman and not a whore, right? She's religious, and she's pretty well off. She's got her own place. Chances are she's not a harlot, right? That's probably maybe what he was thinking. Or maybe he just saw her attire, and she started talking to him, and he wasn't thinking at all. And that's a possibility as well. Now notice something else. She says, "I have peace offerings with me." That's interesting. She has them with her. Now, does that mean she's carrying them in her purse with her? It wouldn't mean that, but it does mean she has them in her possession. Now, why would she have peace offerings with her? That's kind of interesting, because after all, the peace offerings were made at the temple, right? The sacrifices were made at the temple, so why would they be with her? Well, turn with me to verse 9 in Proverbs 7, and this little piece of information will help to shed a little bit of light on it. Proverbs 7 and verse 9. Proverbs 7, 9 says, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. So they're meeting in the evening. It's nighttime. She's got peace offerings with her. She said, this day, there in this verse we're looking at in 14, this day have I paid my vows. So she had paid vows that day, and then that evening, that night, she's got peace offerings with her. This is, actually makes good sense, as we'll see here. So the peace offerings that she had with her would have been what was left over from the sacrifice that she had taken back to her house. And this is what they did with the peace offering. Part of the peace offering would go to the Lord, part of it would go to the priest, and the remainder of it went back with the worshiper back home to be eaten either that day. In some cases, it was that day. In some cases, if it was attached to a vow, it could be eaten the next day, but not the day after that. So she's got this fresh meat with her at her house, which, you know, sounds pretty good. Hey, you want to come and have some beef? You want to have a rack of lamb? I've got this peace offering with me. But let me just show you. I just told you, but let me show you that part of the peace offering went to the Lord. Leviticus chapter 7. Should have had you keep your finger there. Leviticus 7 and verse 31. I'm going to tie a few verses here together, but we're going to see that the fat was the Lord's. Thank the Lord we don't live under the Old Testament anymore. They couldn't eat fat. The Lord got all the fat. Under the New Testament, we can eat all the fat we want, which is the best part of the meat, if you ask me, anyway. So the Lord got the fat. He got the kidneys, which, you know, I would have no problem with that. The caul and the rump of the sheep. And the rump would have been a, you know, good part of the sheep as well. Leviticus 7 and verse 31. It says, and the priest shall burn the fat upon the altar, and the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons'. So I wanted the first part of that. We'll get to the second part later. But the priest would burn the fat upon the altar. And if you compare that with Leviticus chapter 3 and verse 16, it says, and the priest shall burn them upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire for a sweet savor. All the fat is the Lord's. So the fat that they burnt there on the altar was the Lord's. It got burnt up, and its smoke ascends to heaven. It's a sweet smelling savor in God's nose. And then, I shouldn't have turned, in Leviticus 3, 3 through 5, we see here some other parts that were the Lord's as well. And this is referring to the peace offering. You can see that in verse 1. And if his oblation be a sacrifice of peace offering, then he goes on talking about if it's offered from the herd and so on. And then down in verse 3, it says, and he shall offer of the sacrifice of the peace offering an offering made by fire unto the Lord, the fat that covereth the inwards, and all the fat that is upon the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is on them, which is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver, with the kidneys, it shall he take away. And Aaron's son shall burn it on the altar of, or upon the burnt sacrifice, which is upon the wood that is on the fire. It is an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. So the Lord here, according to this, gets the fat around the inwards, he gets the kidneys, he gets the fat on the kidneys, he gets the flanks, by the flanks, he gets the caul above the liver, he gets the kidneys. So those parts were the Lord's. And then down in verses 9 through 11, it says, and he shall offer of the sacrifice of the peace offering an offering made by fire unto the Lord, the fat thereof, and the whole rump. So there's the next part that he gets, the rump, the back end of it. It shall he take off hard by the backbone, and the fat that covereth the inwards, and all the fat that is upon the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them, which is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver, with the kidneys, it shall he take away, and the priest shall burn it upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire unto the Lord. So all that stuff went to the Lord. And then the priests got their part, which was the breast and the right shoulder in Leviticus 7, 14. I think this is somewhat interesting. It doesn't apply to us today, but it is just interesting to see how the sacrifices were made and why this woman has peace offerings with her. And knowing her and her character, she might have just swiped some of it and taken it home anyway when she wasn't supposed to, but I don't think that's what's going on here. Leviticus 7 and verse 14, it says, "And of it he shall offer one out of the whole oblation," which is a sacrifice, another word for sacrifice, "for an heave offering unto the Lord, and it shall be the priests that sprinkleth the blood of the peace offerings, and the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving shall be eaten the same day that it is offered. He shall not leave any of it until the morning." Actually, I wanted to get to that verse later, but that's okay. And then down in verses 31 through 34. So you saw there the priest. This part that was offered there would be the priests, and he would eat it. And then in verses 31 through 34, it says, "And the priest shall burn the fat upon the altar, but the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons'." See, the fat was the Lord's, so it gets burned up, but the breast belongs to Aaron and his sons, and they can eat it. "And the right shoulder shall ye give unto the priest for an heave offering of the sacrifices of your peace offerings. He among the sons of Aaron that offereth the blood of the peace offerings and the fat shall have the right shoulder for his part. For the wave breast and the heave shoulder have I taken of the children of Israel from off the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them unto Aaron the priest and unto his sons by a statute forever from among the children of Israel." So part of what they offered to the Lord was given to the priests for the priests' maintenance. They could eat that for themselves. The wave breast and the heave shoulder. That's what it was called, right? Yeah, wave breast and heave shoulder.
They don't have to eat it on the same day.
They were supposed to eat... I think they were supposed to eat it on the same day. Yeah, in verse 15. "The flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving shall be eaten the same day that it was offered." He would leave none of it till the morning. But part of it could be taken home, especially if there was a vow attached to it, in verse 16. Leviticus 7:16. "But if the sacrifice of his offering be a vow or a voluntary offering, it shall be eaten the same day that he offereth his sacrifice, and on the morrow also the remainder of it shall be eaten." So I take from that on the morrow it's taken home, and the worshiper is eating it. Which is why I think she has the peace offering with her, is how it makes sense to me, anyway. So this might have been an excuse to welcome him into her house. Because, you know, you want a dinner? I mean, I've got this peace offering here. There are actually whores out there, believe it or not, especially married ones, that actually will buy men with gifts. You say, well, that sounds crazy. Well, I have a verse for you. Ezekiel 16, 31 through 33. I don't know how often this happens, but I know that it happened at least once because the Lord was condemning Israel for it. Ezekiel 16, 31 through 33. The Lord says, "In that thou buildest thine eminent place in the head of every way, and makest thine high place in every street, and hast not been an harlot, in that thou scornest Tyre, but as a wife that committeth adultery, which taketh strangers instead of her husband." Well, she's not a harlot. She's not getting paid for her work. She's just an adulteress. She's just taking strangers in for nothing. As a matter of fact, she's paying them. Verse 33, "They give gifts to all whores, but thou givest thy gifts to all thy lovers, and hirest them that they may come unto thee on every side for thy whoredom." So it's kind of a reverse situation here with Israel. She was actually paying them. And the Lord's probably speaking spiritually here also. But you get the point, right? He's not making this point because something like this couldn't happen, obviously. There would be women that would do that. And this woman is pretty well doing that. Hey, she's alluring him with food. They say food is the way to a man's stomach, or the way to a man's heart. Yeah, his heart is, yeah, through his, there you go. Food is the way, yeah. Yeah, the way to his heart is through his stomach, there you go. And then she says, "This day have I paid my vows." Now, paying and making vows was also a part of the religious service of the Jews. And a vow often accompanied the peace offering. Look back in Leviticus chapter 7 again. Leviticus 7:16. Which we already looked at, right? If the sacrifice of his offering be a vow or a voluntary offering, it should be eaten the same day. And this is the chapter talking about the peace offering. So the vow went along with that. You would make a vow and then go make a peace offering, and that would be the accomplishing of the vow. To accomplish means to fulfill, perform, or carry out the vow that was made. And we can see that in Leviticus 22 and verse 21. Leviticus 22, 21. It says, "And whosoever offereth a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord to accomplish his vow, or a free will offering in beeves or sheep, it shall be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no blemish therein." So the sacrifice of the peace offering accomplished the vow. So you made the vow to the Lord, and then to fulfill and carry out that vow and to finish it, you went and made the offering of the peace offering, and that was the completion of the vow. Kind of like with the vow of the Nazarite, he would shave off his hair and burn the hair. And that would be, and he made, I think he made an offering as well, if I remember right. I think it's in Numbers chapter 6, if I remember. But anyway, that was the accomplishing of the vow of the Nazarite. This would be the accomplishing of the vow with a peace offering attached to it. Now, paying a vow to God is a serious matter. In Ecclesiastes 5, and verses 4 through 5, Solomon tells us important nature of this. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 5. He said, "When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay." So you want to be really careful if you make a vow to God that you pay it. You don't tell the Lord, "I'm going to do something," and then don't do it. Right, Lord, if you spare my job, I'm going to come to Bible study every night, or whatever. Right, whatever you say you're going to do, you keep that vow. My Uncle Carl, who's the preacher, and this is commendable. It's pretty wild. When he was in college, he wanted to get back home for Christmas. Of course, he was doing that, still does. But anyway. He wanted to get home for Christmas. He was down in Texas. He was from Pennsylvania, where I am. And he made a vow or a promise to God that if God would get him somehow home for Christmas, then he would give 20% of his gross income for the rest of his life to the Lord. And guess what? He's darn near 70 years old now, and he gives 20% of his gross income to the Lord and has his entire life, even when he raised 5 kids, one of them in a wheelchair and all that. And he's done that his whole life. Because he told God he would. So, he's got character. Yeah. I'll tell you that. And when you vow a vow to God, don't defer to pay it. He's got no pleasure in fools. So, obviously, when she says, "Today, this day I've paid my vows," that means that she's, or well, that's implying anyway, that she's a godly woman, right? She's made a vow. She's kept the vow. She's, right? She's doing what God says to do. If you look in Psalm 116, 12 through 19, Psalm 116, 12 through 19, it says, "What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits toward me? I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. O Lord, truly I am thy servant. I am thy servant and the son of thine handmaid. Thou hast loosed my bonds. I will offer to thee the sacrifice of thanksgiving. I will call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. In the courts of the Lord's house, in the midst of thee, O Jerusalem, praise ye the Lord." So when you pay your vows, I mean, you're doing a godly thing. You're doing it in the presence of all of God's people. You're going to the temple, right? This would imply that she's quite the religious woman, that she's paid her vows that day. She said she'd paid her vows that day. So she had been to worship at the temple earlier that day. This is probably on a Saturday. She'd probably been to the temple on Sabbath. And then now it's Saturday evening. She wasn't, I mean, this makes perfect sense. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. She waited until the evening, till the black and dark night, till Sabbath was over to go to work. Right? That's what she's doing, right? She's going to work after the Sabbath. See, she's a godly woman. I mean, everything matches up here. This woman is a saint. She won't even work on the Sabbath. So this should remind us that it's not only the people that profess to be Christians who are often deceivers, but also those who are regular churchgoers. Right? So just because you meet somebody out there and he goes to church every Sunday doesn't necessarily mean that he's a good guy, that he's a child of God, that he's sincere. There's lots of people that go to church every Sunday because business benefits they can get from it, they look good in the community, that, you know, who knows what? Who knows what their motivation is, but there's plenty of people that do that. This woman did too, apparently. These types of people creep into churches unawares and they turn the grace of God into lasciviousness, which is precisely what this woman's doing. Look at Jude 1 and verse 4. Jude 1 and verse 4. It says, "For there are certain men crept in unawares, who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness, and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ." Lasciviousness is the quality of being lascivious, and lascivious is inclined to lust, lewd, or wanton. Fornicators are lascivious. People that are don't control their sexual lust and passions. Are lascivious, like this woman, turning the grace of God into lasciviousness. Here she is pretending to be a worshiper of God and using that very thing to accomplish her lasciviousness. I think that's pretty interesting. So if this young man had any discernment at all, he would have known that a woman dressed like a harlot on a street corner at night is not a godly, virtuous woman, no matter how religious she may sound. But you know, chances are he was probably overlooking all that stuff, and like a lot of us, he saw what he wanted to see, and he overlooked everything that he didn't want to see. Turn to Proverbs 7:15. We're still walking through the dialogue of the strange woman. In verse 14, she said, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." Verse 15, "Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee." So she says, "Therefore came I forth to meet thee." Now there's a little simple rule of Bible study you always want to remember. When you see a therefore, ask what it's there for. Therefores are really important because therefores connect this verse to the previous one. Therefore means, in consequence of that, that being so, as a result or inference from what has been stated, consequently. So, what she's saying here is that she came out to meet the young man because she is a godly and a religious woman. So she claims. Because in 14, she said, "I have peace offerings with me, this day have I paid my vows." She's a religious, godly, Jewish woman, right? Therefore, because I'm a godly professing Jew, I've come out to meet you. Because I'm not looking for these wretches out here. I'm not looking for these fornicators. I'm looking for a good, godly Jew. I want a religious, spiritual man, because that's what I am. So therefore, because I'm a spiritual, religious woman, I came out to meet you. Well, doesn't that sound good? She's so eager to meet him that she came right out of her house at night to do so. She probably just happened to be sitting there reading the Torah by candlelight in the window, and she just happened to see this godly young man walking around, and she just figured, I better go out and introduce myself to him, because, you know, it's not every day you get to meet a good one like that. That's probably what she was doing. Wouldn't this make that young fool feel so special? Well, I came out to meet you diligently to seek thy face. Diligently is in a diligent manner, with diligence, with steady application, assiduously, industriously, not idly or lazily, with dispatch. So she's not lazy. She wasn't sitting there just, you know, lounging around doing nothing. She sees him, and boy, she bolts right out there. I mean, diligently, she's going to get out there as fast as she can and scoop him up before somebody else does. Diligent, when we're speaking of persons, is constant in application, preserving in endeavor, assiduous, industrious, not idle, not negligent, not lazy. So, I mean, that makes you feel pretty good if a woman's pursuing you with energy and vigor, and she's really trying to get out there and get you. She said, diligently to seek thy face. Seek is to go in search or quest of, to try to find, look for, either a particular object, person, thing, or place, whose whereabouts are unknown, or an indefinite object suitable for a particular purpose. Just like the woman in that parable that would lost her coin and she sought through the whole house and swept the whole thing looking for it, right? Or that shepherd that goes out there and looks for that one lost sheep and he scours the mountains and the valleys and he finally finds it. This is what she does, diligently seeking her prey. And this is one of the characteristics of the wicked. They are diligent, oftentimes more diligent than the righteous, unfortunately. Look at Psalm 64 in verse 6. Just give you a few verses here. Why do you think most of the people that make their way up into high government are wicked? It's because they're more diligent in their goals and aspirations than righteous people are, because righteous people would rather just earn an honest living and be left alone and leave other people alone. But not the types that get up into high levels of government. Psalm 64 and verse 6. They search out iniquities, they accomplish a diligent search. Both the inward thought of every one of them and the heart is deep. These kind of people aren't sitting around talking about the weather. They're not talking about the neighbor, right? Their thoughts are deep. They're thinking about deep things, they're plotting, they're scheming. They have long-term goals. That's why the liberals have managed to pretty much take over the government over the last 100 or so years, and why they constantly win every battle, and the conservatives try to conserve what they currently have. Basically, the liberals make three steps forward, and the conservatives say, okay, we want to conserve this, and we want to stay right here at these three steps forward, and the liberals just power on another three steps, and the conservatives say, okay, let's stop right here. We're just going to conserve this. And they just lose every battle. Because these people, these type of wicked people, they have long-term goals. Like with the whole John Dewey and the public school system, he started that way back, I think it was in the 1930s. And they had these plans of what they wanted to do and how they wanted to indoctrinate a whole generation of people. And, I mean, it wasn't going to happen in a year or 10 years. I mean, they knew it was going to take a long time. And these kind of people, yeah, they don't mind working for some type of a goal that they will never even see in their own lifetimes. That's how evil they are. It's amazing. But, you know, people on the right side of issues, I don't think they have that kind of resolve. And that's why they keep losing over and over again.
What's called a conservative in Congress today is not a conservative.
Oh, no.
Compared to even 15 years ago.
Oh, no. I mean, JFK would have put any of these conservatives to shame, probably, today. I mean, Bill Clinton would put a lot of these conservatives to shame today. Mm-hmm. At least they balance the budget under his tenure. Granted, it was with a Republican Congress, but still. Anyway. These people study destruction. Proverbs 24 and verse 2. Proverbs 24 and verse 2. For their heart studieth destruction, and their lips talk of mischief. See, they're diligent. They accomplish a diligent search. Their inward thoughts are deep, and they're studiers. They're figuring out and working this out in their mind and doing research and figuring out how they're going to do whatever evil they have planned. And they don't sleep until they get it done. Proverbs 4 and verse 16. For they sleep not except they have done mischief, and their sleep is taken away unless they cause some to fall. That strange woman wasn't going to bed that night until she found somebody to go to bed with. Right? They sleep not until they've done mischief. Now, having a, quote, godly, affluent woman setting out on a diligent quest to find him would have made the young fool feel even more special. But if he would have had any sense at all, he would have known that if this woman really was a godly woman, she would have been diligently seeking God, not diligently seeking some man to sin with that night. Look in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6. Hebrews 11, 6. But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That's who we ought to be diligently seeking the face of, God, not some man to sin with like this woman was. And then she says, after having diligently sought his face, I have found thee. Now, I'm just imagining, but I imagine that this was no doubt said with a seductive smile. You can just kind of see her. I've been diligently seeking thy face, and I have found thee. And she gets this real twinkle in her eye and this smile. And she's just so excited. Now he really feels important. Now his guard is down for what comes next in verse 16. Turn to Proverbs 7:16. So in verse 14, the strange woman meets this guy after she kisses him, and with an impudent face she says to him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. So she's decked her bed with coverings of tapestry. So if meeting a woman dressed like a harlot on a street corner late at night who grabbed him and kissed him before she even began talking piously, if that didn't cause suspicion of her character and motives, talking about her bed certainly should have. If up until this point your antenna haven't gone up and you don't see some red flags, when she starts talking about her bed, then you might want to be a little concerned. Because beds have two primary functions, right? Sleeping and sex. Remember what Paul said in Hebrews 13 and verse 4? He said that the marriage bed is undefiled. How do you say that in Hebrews 13, 4? Marriage is honorable and all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. All right, so married people and unmarried people use the bed for that reason. Clearly, there's probably a connotation here. If one of the first subjects of conversation with a woman is her bed, there's a very good chance that she's not just simply tired. She probably is trying to entice you, to allure you. Yeah, she says, I got, what's those, I can't remember those mattresses they box up and ship to you. They were real popular for a while. Anyway, no, I can't remember. It'll come to me in a second.
Sleep Number or?
No, it was after that. This was just a few years ago. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But if she's raving about how wonderful this new bed that she got that just showed up in the box is, yeah, you might want to be a little bit wary. Now, people often invest in equipment that make themselves more productive. And I recommend doing this, right? I've got thousands of dollars of equipment in my office. My great big L-shaped desk, which used to be motorized, which broke and isn't anymore, but two 24-inch monitors on a monitor arm and a Tempur-Pedic office chair. It's very comfortable for me, and LED adjustable arm lights to have lots of bright light on the desk and all kinds of stuff, and a 20-volume OED set and all kinds of other books. And I mean, I've invested a ton of money over the years in my work. And I remember a guy that I used to work with telling me this, to invest in yourself. Mm-hmm. It's wise. It amazes me how some people don't invest in their own work, in their own livelihood. They'll go cheap on things that would make their own work easier. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It'd be like if you're a mechanic and all you have is a crescent wrench because you're just too darn cheap to buy a good set of sockets. I mean, it's insane, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, people do this, right? They invest in their equipment to make themselves more productive. And the strange woman is no different. Her bed is decorated finely. She says, "I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry." Decked is adorned, embellished, set out. To deck is to cover, especially to cover with garments, clothe. To clothe in rich or ornamental garments, to cover with what beautifies, to array, attire, adorn. So her bed is, she's got beautiful adornment to it. It's really impressive looking. It's covered in tapestry. Tapestry is a textile fabric decorated with designs of ornament and pictorial subjects, painted, embroidered, or woven in colors, used for wall hangings, curtains, coverings, for seats, to hang from windows or balconies on festive occasions, etc., especially such as decorated fabric in which a weft containing ornamental designs in colored wool or silk, gold or silver thread, etc., is worked with bobbins or brooches and pressed close with a comb on a warp of hemp or flax stretched in a frame. If you understood what any of that was talking about, that's how you make tapestry. So it's this beautiful fabric which has a bunch of stuff woven into it, and gold and silver and pictures and things like that. It's really pretty. It's kind of like a quilt, I guess, only probably a really, really nice, fancy quilt. So she says she's got, she's decked her bed with tapestry with carved works, she said. So her bed is adorned with carved wood. And this is the kind of adorning that the temple of God had in 1 Kings 6:35. So this woman is a woman of means. Well, her husband went away with a bag of money, so he's got some money. And apparently he liked having a nice bedroom set up. Probably didn't realize that she was using it for other reasons. 1 Kings 6:35 says, "And he carved thereon cherubims and palm trees and open flowers and covered them with gold fitted upon the carved work." So there's an example of carved works, right? A wooden piece. This is, in this case, it was in the temple where you had flowers and cherubims, which are angels, and palm trees, and you know, these beautiful things carved into it, and then overlaid with gold. Now, I don't know if hers was overlaid with gold or not, but anyway, you know, a nice carved wood bedpost, bed frame, that's pretty fancy, pretty nice. So this type of ornate woodwork would be very expensive and would possibly lead him to think that she's not a cheap tramp, right? Because, you know, she's at least, well, you know, we know she's a harlot. He apparently didn't, but so we at least know she's either a successful one or else she's got somebody footing the bill for her, one of the two. And then she says she's decked her bed with fine linen of Egypt. Fine is of superior quality, choice of its kind. Linen is cloth woven from flax, and flax is the plant linum, some other scientific term that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, bearing blue flowers which are succeeded by pods containing the seeds commonly known as linseed. It is cultivated for its textile fiber and for its seeds. You've probably heard of flaxseed, right? Flaxseed oil people like to eat. It's supposed to be good for you, I've been told. Well, this is what linen is made out of. Fine linen is very costly and precious. I'll just give you some examples of this to show you. First of all, kings are arrayed, or were arrayed, in fine linen. If you look back in Genesis 41, in verse 42, we'll see that this was not exactly some type of a bed sheet from Walmart. I mean, this was some really nice stuff here. Genesis 41 and verse 42. Not that there's anything wrong with bed sheets from Walmart. I've got a few of them myself. But this woman was a woman of class. Genesis 41 and verse 42. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. Remember, Joseph was second in command of Egypt. He was the prime minister. And this is the kind of stuff that royalty wore, fine linen. And this is what her sheets are made out of. 1 Chronicles 15 and verse 27. You can see how this would sound pretty tantalizing to this young man. 1 Chronicles 15, 27. But what he should have done is, number one, not been walking around at that hour. And when a woman comes up to you dressed like a harlot, turn the other way. And especially when she grabs you and kisses you, get away. But the longer you listen, the more enticing it sounds. She's got peace offerings. This day she paid her vow. She's been diligently seeking you. And she's got this beautiful bed and this amazing bedroom. And this just sounds like, I at least want to check it out. I mean, I'm not going to do anything, but I just want to see what it looks like, right? It's got to be beautiful, right? You can just imagine what this idiot's thinking. 1 Chronicles 15 and verse 27. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 27. And David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, and all the Levites that bear the ark, and the singers, and the Kenaniah, the master of the song, with the singers. David also had upon him an ephod of linen. So David the king is also clothed in fine linen. And not only were kings clothed in fine linen, but God's tabernacle was made out of fine linen. Exodus 25 and verse 4. So I gather from this, if God's king is clothed in fine linen, and God's tabernacle is made out of fine linen, and the priests are clothed in fine linen, which I'll get to in a minute, this must be about the finest stuff that you can get, because, you know, God really, he wanted it done up as good as could be. So I take it that if the woman had fine linen sheets, that's about it. It's like silk sheets or something. It's about as good as it gets. Exodus 25 and verse 4. It says, in blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair. This is referring to the tabernacle. And then also the priests were clothed in fine linen. Exodus 28 and verse 39. And thou shalt embroider the coat of fine linen, and thou shalt make the mitre of fine linen, and thou shalt make the girdle of needlework. And he's talking about Aaron and his sons here. He says, and make them coats, and so on in the next verse. This was the mitre, which was the hat, and the coat of the priest were to be of fine linen. So a bed such as she described here would be tempting to want to see and sleep in. As I mentioned before, some whores, even married ones especially, they actually try to buy men with gifts and luxurious accommodations, maybe in this case. And we already saw that verse in Ezekiel 16, 31 through 33, where the Lord charged Israel with that. It says, you're not a harlot because harlots are paid for their work. You don't take any pay. You're actually paying them for it, right? And so we already looked at that. I'm not going to read it again. So the allure of the strange woman is building. And if this young man doesn't run soon, it's going to be too late. Now, next time we'll get to verse 17, where she continues to talk about her bed and how it's perfumed with all these nice spices. So not only does it look beautiful, it smells really nice too. And the temptation is just continuing to grow for this young man. Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.